University of California Television presents this podcast of Conversations with History, featuring Kenneth N. Waltz discussing theory and international politics, recorded in February 2003. UCTV's Conversations with History series is hosted by Harry Kreisler, director of UC Berkeley's Institute of International Studies. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Kenneth Waltz, who was the Ford Professor of Political Science at Berkeley. He also taught at Swarthmore and Brandeis, and now is adjunct professor of political science at Columbia University. Professor Waltz is a former president of the American Political Science Association and a recipient of its James Madison Award for Distinguished Scholarly Contributions to Political Science. He's the author of numerous books, including Man, the State and War, Theory of International Politics, Foreign Policy and Democratic Politics, and co-author with Scott Sagan of The Spread of Nuclear Weapons. Ken, welcome back to Berkeley.
Nice to be back.
Where were you born and raised?
Ann Arbor, Michigan.
And
went through high school there.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
Not very much. My father never went to high school. And my mother never got out of high school, so they were not people of great political interest or insight. Mm-hmm.
So, did you have any teachers when you were growing up that shaped your interest in politics or your writing skills? Actually,
well, I had an excellent English teacher in the 10th grade, who taught me everything there is to know about grammar and word usage. And that was a very valuable, it was not a lot of fun at the time, but it was a very valuable semester, and I treasure it.
Went
to Ann Arbor High School, which was then such a good high school that if one was on the college preparatory program and got a C-plus average, one was automatically admitted to the University of Michigan.
Oh, gee. Yeah. What world events occurred during your growing up years, and did any of them particularly impact you?
Well, the prolonged depression, mm-hmm. prolonged and deep, that influenced everybody. And, of course, what was going on in Europe kind of passed us over, but it was not much talked about by history or social science teachers in high school. There was only one who really made much of it, which is rather surprising. Mm-hmm. And I was not especially interested. I was more interested in math and physics and drama.
Mm-hmm. Drama.
And rhetoric and that sort of thing than I was in politics or world events.
Mm-hmm. And where did you do your undergraduate work?
I started at Oberlin, and I graduated from Oberlin.
Mm-hmm. And what was your major?
I started as a math major, almost completed it, and then shifted to economics.
Mm-hmm. And what attracted you, what about economics attracted you?
Well, I thought I knew two things. One is I didn't want to have a career in which I taught. I didn't want to have a career in which I was expected to write. So I thought, well, economics would give me a variety of choices, and from government to business. And then, of course, I went to graduate school at Columbia in economics, and I could see that I was not going to be a real economist. And if you're not attracted to a field enough to read beyond the requirements, just to read more because you're curious and you want to know more than is required in any given course. If that's not the case, then you're in the wrong field. So I finally began to ask myself, what did I really enjoy most in high school in college? And the answer was English literature and political philosophy. Mm-hmm. So I audited a lot of English literature courses and loved it, but realized that I would never write a novel or a poem. And I would therefore be a critic, a very honorable profession, but it didn't inspire me. So political philosophy won, and I'm very pleased it did.
And any teachers that you had at Columbia or at Oberlin that pointed you in either of these two directions?
Well, in fact, the teacher and the wife of the teacher who influenced me most was John Lewis, mm-hmm. and his wife Ewart Lewis.
And they were at
they were at Oberlin.
Oberlin, yeah.
And I took two half courses from John Lewis, one in theory, mm-hmm. and the other in American government. But I lived with the Lewises for a semester, and Ewart Lewis was a highly knowledgeable person in the field of medieval thought, and published a book, one volume version by Knopf and two volumes by Roger Kegan Paul, called Medieval Political Ideas. Mm-hmm. And we had very interesting kitchen conversations about the interpretation of St. Augustine, for example. Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed all of that immensely. So when trying to make the final decision, my wife and I went back to Oberlin and visited the Lewises and talked about it. That confirmed what was by then a strong inclination, and I shifted from economics to political science.
Before we talk about your first book, what exactly does a political theorist do?
Thinks. Political theorists there are two kinds of political theorists, really. One is a political theorist who writes about other people's political theories. Mm-hmm. And that, of course, in the traditional political theory field is what is done mostly. It's a reconsideration of Hobbes on this point or Locke on that point. And the other thing, if one wants to try to develop theory or promote its development, it is to think about ways of doing that. And the first book was really a sorting out book. Mm-hmm. And the second book was an attempt to develop mm-hmm. a theory of international politics in the sense in which it had not been developed before. The second theory book, in a sense in which it had not been developed before.
Before we talk about those two books, help us understand, first, how does a person prepare to do theory? What kind of curriculum should one undergo to do that in a satisfactory way?
If you want to deal with theory as theory and not as the history of political philosophy, which incidentally is a part of the field that I love, and it's a marvelous literature, but I didn't feel inclined to rehash it. If one wants to develop theory, I think the direct route is to read a good deal of philosophy of science mm-hmm. and take courses. Good courses are available in the philosophy of science. I mean, the first requirement if you're going to work on a theory or the improvement of somebody else's theory is to figure out what a theory is, mm-hmm. which very few people seem to do. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time reading the philosophy of science because it's a very difficult question. You know, what is a theory? What can it do? What can it not do? How do you test its validity or seeming validity? It's a profound and difficult subject in its own right. It also is a field in which there's a great literature. Mm-hmm. And it was a pleasure for me to read in the philosophy of science and not to have to read a lot more political science.
Are you allowed to say that as a former president of the American Political Society?
I do say it. I do say it.
So what does a theory do?
A theory, first, in order to have a theory, you have to have a subject matter. You can't have a theory about everything. There's no such thing as a theory about everything. So you have to say, well, I'm gonna try to develop a theory of, in this case, international politics. So the first question is, how can you think of international politics as a domain in its own right, as something that you could possibly have a theory about?
Right? And how do you decide that you can do that?
You have to figure out a way of defining it as an autonomous field of study. Mm-hmm. The closest comparison is the development of economic theory, mm-hmm. where before the physiocrats, that is before roughly 1760, that economists wrote about all kinds of things, mainly at the level of bookkeeping, or what we might now call accounting, family and business accounts, that sort of thing. It was only with the physiocrats, who greatly influenced Adam Smith, that the concept of an economy is something that could be studied in its own right, developed. And once that concept existed, then it became at least possible to have a theory about how national economies work, right? Mm-hmm. What regularities appear, what repetitions occur, how you can think of it as a self-sustaining enterprise. Right? And that the breakthrough was the physiocrats, and then, of course, the great follow-through was Adam Smith.
So if you're going to do theory of international politics, then at one level you probably have to be grounded in the history of the domain,
so to speak. You need to know. I don't see how you can do it without knowing a good deal of history. But the main thing is to have that conception of international politics as something that could be studied in its own right. It's something that, for example, to name two major figures in the field, Hans Morgenthau and Raymond Aron, Frenchmen, thought was impossible. I mean, how can you isolate international politics, even for the purpose of study, mm-hmm. from everything else that goes on? And their answer was, you can't. Mm-hmm. And in that case, it's not possible to develop a theory of international policy. Because international policy is something that's influenced by everything else. Mm-hmm. National economy, national politics, international politics, and it's all just interrelated. There's no way of separating it. So the first requirement was to develop an idea of the structure of international politics, which would make it possible to think of international politics as a subject matter that could be studied in its own right. Mm-hmm. And that's what I did in the theory of international mm-hmm. politics.
Now, how does one then evaluate a theory? I've got to be, as a former student, I have to be careful here in the words that I use in asking you questions. But in other words, is usefulness a good way to evaluate a theory, and how do you know when a theory is useful?
Well, whether or not a theory is useful is really decided by the body of people who find it worthwhile to use the theory mm-hmm. or to argue about the theory. As Steve Weinberg, who's a Nobel laureate in physics, and I am a very reflective physicist, has said, ultimately the test of a theory is that people, meaning the people in the field, find it worth dealing with, mm-hmm. right? Arguing about, criticizing, mm-hmm. trying to apply.
Mm-hmm. And the purpose of a theory is to explain what's going on, how the order hangs together. Clarify that for us.
Yeah. What a theory does is present a mental picture mm-hmm. of a part of the world. And in that picture are identified the major causal factors at work. And the theory specifies the relations among those, and the necessary relations, that is, they're necessary within the terms of the theory, right? Among those major causal forces, which we often now refer to as variables, right? Mm-hmm. Adopting a scientific terminology that's not always useful, but that's a simple way of putting it, mm-hmm. right?
Yes.
And then you can compare that picture and the supposed causal forces at work with real world. Mm-hmm. And that's always a problematic exercise, because the theory is very simple. Mm-hmm. What theories do is leave most everything out. I mean, you're simplifying, you're looking for what is really salient. What are the central propelling forces? Right? Mm-hmm. And obviously they're not the only forces at work, so you've got that problem that natural scientists have too, but they can usually or often control for perturbations that come in from outside the system, right? Whereas in politics, generally, in international politics in particular, you can't do. Right? So it makes for endless argument and a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The theory has an economy about it, because, I mean, at one level you can say, well, there's so much going on in the world, let's put it all in the theory. But that's not the game here. In other words, there's not a one-to-one relationship. This is not an effort to replicate everything that's going on.
If it were, then the ideal theory would be identical with the real world, right? And instead, theory is a simple instrument which you hope to be able to use in order to understand and explain the real world. And the emphasis is on explanation, not on prediction. Prediction is nice. If you can predict, fine. But the key requirement of a theory that is not able to explain what's going on, then it's not a theory, or it's not a it's a worthless theory, not a theory at all.
Well, has your work been influenced a lot by economic theory, or is it merely that you were a student of economics in an earlier phase of your life?
It's influenced very much by microeconomic theory. It really is built on a microeconomic theory label. That was, I would say, the major influence. And the second influence is anthropology, mm-hmm. which I never studied, but wrote in as formally as a student. But I read a great deal of anthropology, and the analogy is between segmentary lineage systems, or in Durkheim's terms, mechanical societies, rather than organic societies or solidary societies, and the analogy is quite close. Right?
Mm-hmm. Now, what about political scientists? Any teachers or intellectual influences that stand out, other than obviously the classical literature, which we'll talk about in a minute?
I never had. I mean, I had some very good professors in the field of international politics, but none of them were people who were attuned to theory in the sense in which I have been talking about it. Mm-hmm. Certainly, everybody dealt with those who were considered to be the major theoretically oriented people in the field, as we know from Thucydides onward.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your first book, yeah. Man, the State, and War. And there, the problem was what?
Well, the problem was very simple. For me, political theory was my major, and you had to have a second field, and I chose international politics because having worked in international economics, it gave me some kind of a start, but I was keeping it to a minimum. And there was a professor at Columbia at the time who was accustomed to making deals with people who were only minors in the field, that you could cover certain things and leave others aside. And we worked it out. I would do European diplomatic history, imperialism, and so on. I would not do international law and organization, which I never found attractive. And then he got sick. Mm-hmm. So he could not appear on the oral exams of people who were minors. The alternative was William T.R. Fox. So I went to see him, and I explained this arrangement that I had made. And he said he had never heard of any such arrangement.
I see.
So he called up the departmental secretary, who knew everybody and everything mm-hmm. that was going on in the department, and she said, yes, Professor Pfeffer did customarily make such arrangements with minor students.
Right?
And I can still remember this. Bill Fox, as I came to call him later, hung up, turned his chair toward me and said, nevertheless, if you're going to do international politics, you're going to do international politics. No, I had no choice. Well, I had completed my reading in that minor field, I thought, mm-hmm. and was going to spend the remaining few weeks on my major interest, political theory. And instead, I spent those few weeks frantically reading widely as possible. My wife's help, she was getting books out of the library for me, in the field of international politics generally. And I could not make head or tail of it. It was a most confusing literature. Hmm. And finally, it came to me. I still have somewhere the yellow piece of paper on which I wrote this down. The reason these people are confusing is because they're thinking in different causal terms. Mm-hmm. And some are thinking that, well, the causes of what goes on in the world in international relations, the causes are rooted in human beings, mm-hmm. what human beings are like. Right? And others are saying, well, the causes are found in states. Good states don't fight wars, democracy. And so now the idea of the democratic peace. Good states don't fight wars, bad states fight wars. And then the definition of good and bad varies. For a Marxist, it's a socialist state is the good state. For a liberal, it's the democratic state. And so everything's rooted in what states are like. And then there's the third way of looking at it, that really at the international political level, that the causes are found And although the causes do operate at those two other levels, they operate in this context, and the context is extremely important.
So, in summary, you called each of the you labeled each a different image. So, image one looks to the causes of war in the nature of man.
Right.
Image two looks at the causes of war in the nature of state, whether it's a democracy or a
authoritarian dictatorship
or whatever.
Right.
But the third realm looks at international politics as a separate political domain or a separate domain.
Exactly.
So hence an opening, really, to begin looking for a theory, basically.
That's right. Yeah. And I remember people, specifically a professor at Oberlin, George Lani, saying to me, what's going to be the sequel to Man, the State, and War? And I said, I don't have an idea about how I could write a sequel. Mm-hmm. So from 1959 until the late 60s, I didn't have any sequel in mind. And then I began to think why do these things develop in one's mind? Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
I began to think of a way of, or ask myself at least the question of how might a theory of international politics be possible? And that's when I began to read, and more widely in anthropology and very widely in philosophy of science, and I finally developed the notion, and it took a period of years to develop a notion and fill it out, figure out ways of presenting it effectively and so on. And then that's what one finds in the book, Theory of International Politics.
And we'll talk about that in a minute, but I can't resist asking you something about Man, the State, and War, because it appears superficially that in one sense you're rejecting the first two images out of hand. But as I'm rereading it, I saw things differently, and I just want to be clear about this. You're saying in Man, the State, and the War that the underlying cause of war is the third image, whereas the first two images are immediate causes. So there is a continuing interplay between them, even though really the thrust of the analysis is toward the third image.
Exactly right.
Okay. Yeah. So we can come back to those images later when we're talking about American policy in a minute. So you mentioned that you set about now to actually do a theory of international politics, and what did you conclude? Help us understand. You could do a theory, but help us understand by talking a little about your theory. What is the nature of this realm of international politics?
It's the structure of the system is the international political system is defined first by its organizing principle, which is anarchy. Mm-hmm. Some people would think of that as a disorganizing principle, but it's a principle that tells one how the major units of the realm relate to one another. Right? And the relation is one of anarchy as opposed to hierarchy. Mm-hmm. It's not an ordered realm. It's not a law-bound realm. It's a realm in which the various units have to figure out for themselves how they're going to try to live with one another and how they're going to pursue specifically and ultimately how they're going to manage their own security worries in this anarchic realm, which is simply described as a realm of self-help. Mm-hmm. If you don't do it for yourself, you cannot count on anybody else doing it for you. They may help, they may not, but you don't know. You can't count on that. You're on your own. Right? And the second defining principle is by the distribution of capability among those units, right? With the more capable ones, of course, shaping the realm, posing the problems that the others have to deal with. And the analogy there, of course, is between international politics on the one hand and oligopolistic sectors of an economy on the other hand. Right? It's not a purely competitive realm. It's one in which the major actors, those of the greater of greater capability, set the scene in which the others must act.
Now, in layman's term, in terms of the first part of your analysis, what you're really saying is, look, there's no international police force. There's no real international court. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, these things can't be adjudicated. Mm-hmm. So that's really what you mean when you're trying to help us understand the organizing principle. So states have to act on their own.
Right.
They have to do it for themselves.
Right.
Now, the second part of this is really to say that the key understanding of the system comes from the way the capability of one actor has vis-a-vis the others.
Right.
Okay. So what then helps us understand the outcomes in a particular situation in the world? Just these things? Are these the things we have to look at to understand what's going on in the world?
Right. And the first one, of course, anarchy remains, and unless somehow a world government is ever developed, international politics will be an anarchic realm. So that's a variable that doesn't vary, if you want to use those terms. The second part of the definition is where one finds the variation. That is, we've known worlds historically, and of course we can also imagine them in the pure realm of theory, in which there are varying numbers of great powers. Always up until World War II in modern history, there were five or so great powers contending. World War II eventuated in a world in which there were only two, the United States and the Soviet Union. Now, in the states acting in those two different worlds face different kinds of problems. And it's interesting to recall the reflections that were made and the arguments that were conducted shortly after World War II. That is, the difficulty, for example, that previous great powers, countries like Great Britain and France, had coming to terms with the fact that they were no longer great powers, that they were reduced to the level of major powers. And the reduction directly affected their behavior. I mean, they had to adjust to a different kind of world that made a different kind of policy, different kinds of actions appropriate or inappropriate. Right? Mm-hmm. To use an old-fashioned terminology, they became not providers of their own security, but consumers of their own security. Now, a simple distinction like that explains a lot. It explains how Europe could develop as a somewhat distinct political realm. It no longer had France no longer had to worry about a possible war with Germany, or as it had in preceding times, a possible war against Britain. Right? We worried about that. The Soviet Union worried about that. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't much they could do about it. I mean, they could make marginal differences in the system, but they could not provide for their own security vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. They had to rely on an outside power because the capabilities had shifted so much in that way. So whole new kinds of behavior become possible for the previous great powers because they're no longer great powers, just for that simple reason. And the United States assumes new responsibilities that it never dreamed of assuming. Right? In the 1930s, to tell an American that America would begin to take the responsibility for the security of major parts of the world would have been laughable. Nobody could even imagine such a condition existing. But when the structure of international politics dramatically changed, we accommodated ourselves to that new condition.
Why is it so hard in our perceptions of the world, and even your political science colleagues, the great difficulty they have in understanding the implications of structure in today's world. One thinks of globalization. In an earlier phase, the word was interdependence.
Right.
So there is a penchant for finding new trends and then saying the game is all over with regard to structure and these relational issues. Why is that?
I think it's simply because the actors you observe, I mean, who is it doing things in the world? Well, it's states, right? And the interrelation of states. And those interrelations do vary. They're sometimes closer, they're sometimes looser, right? It's states that do things, and especially it's the states of greatest power who do things. So if you're looking at immediate causes, that's where you find the immediate causes, mm-hmm. right? And it takes an act of the mind to conceive of how the conditions under which these actions and interactions occur, that the conditions under which they occur have a great influence on the actions and interactions of themselves. That's not something that you open your eyes and look at and see, mm-hmm. or you read about in the New York Times mm-hmm. every morning. It takes an act of thought to do that. And the globalization is a very interesting example of this. Well, what appears to us as globalization appears to much of the world, mm-hmm. no doubt to most of the world, very simply, as Americanization. Mm-hmm. Right? In other words, the world is no longer bipolar, it's now unipolar. There is one great power and one only. And this is a condition that has not existed since Rome. That is, no country has dominated the relevant part of the globe since Rome to the extent that we do. And of course, Rome's realm was a part of the world, and our realm is the entire globe.
Before we talk about this new position of the U.S. in the world, I want to ask you one thing. I know that you wrote quite a bit about the stability of the bipolar world, and that was unconventional when you wrote about that at the time you wrote about it, because the very interactions between us and the Soviets were creating this Cold War fear that made people not want to accept what you're saying, and I'm curious where that leads me is talk a little about that. I mean, it was structure that made you see the stability that was actually there, which many people were not seeing.
That's right. Looking back, it was published in 1964. It was strangely controversial. It made people mad. Mm-hmm. I first gave the paper as a talk to the Harvard-MIT Arms Control Seminar, and there was a lively and heated discussion following the presentation of this simple idea that this has become a world of two powers. In other words, a bipolar world. And people are saying, "No, wait a minute, Europe still counts." And, you know, well, of course, Europe still counted, but not nearly as much as, obviously, it once did, and not nearly as much as the United States and the Soviet Union. Ultimately, the world's fate depended on the United States, the Soviet Union, and the interaction between them, right? And it was in economic terms, it was not a world of interdependence at all. The United States and the Soviet Union scarcely traded with one another, right? Militarily, the interdependence was close because each could do grievous damage to the other. Right? And in international politics, again, a realm of self-help, ultimately that's what counts. Right? So within, I'd say, certainly within 10 years, probably less than 10 years, it became accepted, you know, of course the world is bipolar. And that makes the really deep controversy with which this article mm-hmm. was greeted all the more striking.
Were you surprised when the Soviet Union disappeared?
Not especially. I had been giving lectures in the United States and abroad in which I pointed out, and this goes back to the late 70s, not the very late, the middle to late 70s, in which I had been arguing that the Soviet Union was in a steady decline. And if you recall the 1980s, this is when Reagan and those who agreed with him were saying the Soviet Union is catching up with us, they're going to pass us. Right? The Soviet Union has become the most powerful military country in the world. Reagan, you know, they've passed us on all fronts, strategic and conventional alike. Well, the opposite was the truth. The Soviet, and one could see it. I mean, you could look at data. You could look at the demographic composition of the Soviet Union, with the Russian component sinking and the non-Russian component of the population rising. You could look at the extent to which the Soviet Union is falling behind in military technology, and indeed, of course, in technology across the board, and therefore in military technology as well. I mean, it looked to me as though the Soviet Union was on a losing course. You could also see it in the fact that the Soviet Union couldn't adjust to change, agriculture being the best example. It just kept doing the same wrong things year after year, decade after decade. It was a very static government. It found making changes very difficult, right? And thus, of course, the change when it did come was a big and shocking one. But I wrote, even in this a book published in 1979, was that the real question in the world was, would the Soviet Union be able to keep up with the United States? Right? And I developed that idea in some publications and in a lot of talks. And again, very controversial. Mm-hmm. I remember especially being in China for the first time in 1982 and presenting this analysis to one of the institutes, which I've now talked at over the years four or five times, and the last time was in 1996. I reminded them in 1992 what they were saying was, hey, the Soviet Union's getting ahead, right? Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's why China was moving toward the United States, because it felt that the United States was getting weaker, and in order to form a block of sufficient strength against the Soviet Union, they had to edge over toward our side. Mm-hmm. Right? Again, perceptions of what the structure of international politics is at a given time, those perceptions strongly influence the policy that one follows. Right? So mm-hmm. I was saying, no, the Soviet Union is getting weaker. Mm-hmm. The United States is getting relatively stronger. And the people at this institute who were charged with thinking about this, was the purpose of their institute was to mm-hmm. think about things like this. They had reached the opposite conclusion. Mm-hmm. They were wrong.
Yeah. So we have the situation now in the contemporary world where we're in a unipolar world. The enormity of U.S. power, military, economic, in comparison to everybody else, is quite amazing. What is the greatest danger of such a world?
The greatest danger was described very well by a French cleric who died in 1713, was also a counselor to rulers, of course, in which he said, I have never known a country disposing of overwhelming power to behave with forbearance and moderation for more than a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And we've seen this over and over again. It illustrates nicely how states fail to learn from history, from other countries' experiences. Time and time again, countries that disposed of overwhelming power as we now do have abused that power. There are no, the key characteristic of a unipolar world is that there are no checks and balances against that power. So it's free to follow its fancy. It's free to act on its whims. Since there are very minor, very weak external constraints, everything depends on the internal politics of the country in question. Mm-hmm. Now, it is possible, of course, to imagine that the internal politics would be a restraint. Checks and balances are supposed to work in the United States. That's ingrained in our thinking. But, in fact, they don't work very well. Or at least in my view, they are not working very well. They do not place effective constraints on what the government can do abroad. They do not place effective constraints on how much we spend on our military forces. In 1898, for example, we outspent the next eight big spenders.
In what year? I'm sorry.
1998. 1998. Right. And We're now spending about as much as the next 14 or 15, and according to the New York Times projecting the spending till next year, we will be spending as much as all the other countries in the world combined on our military forces. Now, what do we want all that military force for? Other countries are bound to ask that question. Mm-hmm. They do ask that question, and they worry about it because power can be so easily abused.
So what is likely, or what is going to happen down the road? Will it be that it doesn't appear that others can organize against us? Is there a danger that we will shoot ourselves in the foot, basically?
Exactly.
Yeah.
The gap between the United States and others, technologically as well as militarily, the military gap is simply obvious. Nobody can miss it, right? But that's based on our economy and our technological abilities. And the gaps have become so wide that no combination of other countries and no other country singly in the foreseeable future is going to be able to balance the power of the United States. In the foreseeable future, you know, in the end, power will balance power. There isn't any doubt but what the Chinese are smarting under, are very uncomfortable with, the extent to which the United States dominates the world militarily. Now, I'm not implying that it doesn't bother other countries as well, but China, if it maintains its political coherence, its political capabilities, will have, in due course, the economic and the technological means of competing. But how far away is that? Mm-hmm. Certainly 20 years, mm-hmm. probably more than 20 years.
The perception of the Bush administration and the men of ideas, however faulty, around the Bush administration is that there is a new configuration in the world.
There is.
And that configuration and the threat, even to the most powerful country in the world, but also the world, is the link between so-called rogue regimes. Mm-hmm. They're getting the capacity to act with weapons of mass destruction, mm-hmm. Nuclear, biological, and chemical, and their links to transnational terrorist organizations. Mm-hmm. That is the rationale the primary rationale for the new preemptive strategy.
Right.
What is your analysis of that apparent configuration of power as a realist?
Yeah.
Does a realist say this is baloney or what?
I can tell you exactly what this realist
yes,
says.
Okay.
Right. In the first case, in the first instance, one wants to point out that the word preemption here is entirely misleading. Preemption, by its dictionary usage and by its common usage among people who think about military strategy, is that preemption occurs when you have good, very strong reasons for believing that the adversary is just about to strike, and you strike. It would make sense if you knew that and knew it pretty much for sure to strike first. Now, we have no reason to think that Saddam Hussein is about to strike anybody, not anybody in the region, let alone Europe or the United States. I mean, that's entirely fanciful. So it's not a case for preemption. The question is it a case for prevention? The rationale of prevention is that over time, the adversary will become so strong that you better fight him earlier while he's relatively weak and you can win easily instead of waiting until he becomes strong. And then you would have a more difficult war. Well, Iraq is so weak. I mean, its gross domestic product is $15 billion. We're spending almost $400 billion on our military alone. I mean, it's a pitifully weak country, much weaker than it was in 1991 when we fought the Gulf War. And we know that, and then American military estimates bear that out. So the question becomes the one that you pose. might a country such as Iraq develop nuclear and other weapons of mass destruction and then share them with terrorists? The first point to make about that is they can't use them themselves. They are contained and deterred.
That is the regime.
Right. No matter how often the Bush administration people say containment and deterrence does not work, it works as well as it ever did for the purposes that we always thought it was designed to accomplish. That is, it deters other countries from using their weapons in ways that it would endanger the manifestly vital interests of the United States or those it supports. So the question reduces to, might they give these things away? Well, I don't think we'd have to worry about Saddam Hussein doing that, because if any terrorists ever get weaponry that they could not well get from sources other than Iraq, we would say, Saddam Hussein did it, and we'd slam him. And he knows that. Mm-hmm. It's a funny thing that over and over again, people, and we hear it every day, say that these rogues are undeterrable. Do you want to rely on the sanity of Saddam Hussein? George Bush has said, I do not want to rely on the sanity of Saddam Hussein. I do. This guy is a survivor. He's been in power for 34 years. Mm-hmm. People who are insane do not maintain themselves in power against a host of enemies, internally as well as externally. Mm-hmm. I mean, they have been able, this is true of Gaddafi in the old days, who we used to think of as being very roguish. We don't think of him being so roguish anymore. It's true of Kim Il-sung. It was true of his father. I mean, these rogues, these guys we call rogues, are survivors. Mm-hmm. Now, how can you at once be foolhardy to the point of insanity and be survivors in a very difficult world? It's much more difficult than winning a second term for a president of the United States. Right? Mm-hmm. These guys are really pressed from all sides, as I say, internally and externally as well. And they survive. They're crafty. They're ugly. They're nasty. I mean, I believe all those things. But they're also crafty. Mm-hmm. You've got to carry them out in a box. They've got power, and they want to hold it, and they want to continue to hold it, right? And they want to pass it on to their progeny, as a matter of fact. They have proved themselves able to calculate where that line is, that crossing that line means you're going to be put out of business. I mean, if you don't, to be a ruler, you have to have a country to rule. If you invite intense retaliation upon yourself, you're dead, and your country is destroyed as a going political entity. Nobody's going that far. These rogues are self-limiting.
Now, what is your answer to people who would say to you, you are too focused on the state as a unit in addressing these current problems, that you are dealing with, now obviously Iraq and North Korea are states, but when you begin to talk about Al-Qaeda and what they might accomplish, that these are not states.
Right.
They are units or entities that could obtain these weapons, whether from North Korea or Saddam Hussein, that conceivably could steal them from the former Soviet Union, and could act in a way that would affect us and our national security, if not our relative position in the world. What I'm trying to get at is, what should the greatest power in the world be doing about these kinds of threats in a way that's consistent with a realist view of the world?
It's almost impossible to believe that Saddam Hussein, these states do act as units. I mean, they're
right.
You could say Saddam Hussein. Yeah. You don't always have to say Iraq. And the same for North Korea, right? They act very much as units. That he would go to such tremendous lengths to acquire nuclear military capability. Remember, the Israelis destroyed their nuclear facilities at Iraq in June of 1981. I mean, this goes back a long time, and this is has been a persistent, sustained effort on the part of Saddam Hussein to acquire this military capability. Now, if he ever were to achieve it, he certainly would not want to share it with anybody. Mm-hmm. He would guard it. He would have only a small capability. It's possible to control a small number, a small amount of nuclear materials and a small number of nuclear warheads, a small number of delivery systems, in a way that is very difficult if you have hundreds, or especially if you have thousands, as we and Russia do. If you're going to steal something, it's a much, much better bet stealing it from Russia than it is trying to steal it from a new, and because new, necessarily very small, nuclear power. I mean, if you got a lot of it, it's hard to keep track of. The United States has lost track of some of its nuclear material, which a lot of people overlook or forget about, right? We've got so damn much of it. How are you going to keep track of all of it, right? Mm-hmm. But boy, if you have 10 or 20 or 50, it's pretty easy to keep track of that stuff. And it's also very easy to believe, and Saddam Hussein would have to believe this, if that somehow some terrorists got hold of nuclear materials or nuclear warheads, we would say, we have evidence that. Or he'd have to believe that we might say, mm-hmm. we have evidence that this came from Saddam Hussein, boom, mm-hmm. like that.
Now, let's separate this from Saddam Hussein. Let's sure. say that Al Qaeda or factions of Al Qaeda would come to power mm-hmm. in Pakistan, basically,
yep.
and, which is a possibility. A yep. very divided country, and so on. I guess what I'm trying to get at is, would that situation sort of change the equation? You know, in the sense that the rationality, which we can assume that Saddam Hussein has mm-hmm. as a survivor of mm-hmm. power, would that be the same of a group? Would they be socialized by state power, I guess, is the question.
Yeah.
Or might they do things because of their ideology, which is a deviant form of Islam, which at one level seems to say to die is good.
Yeah. One of the striking things about nuclear deterrence is that it has worked. No matter what country we're talking about, no matter what kind of government the country has had, no matter what kind of ruler the country has had, the most striking case, of course, is Mao Zedong and the Cultural Revolution. It lasted from 1966 to 1976. In China, where China was in seemingly utter and complete chaos. And yet, China, a country with a fair number of nuclear weapons at the time, managed to take care of those weapons very well indeed. And it was the government separated foreign policy to a certain extent from the Cultural Revolution and nuclear policy completely. In the Cultural Revolution. Now, the one thing those governments, millenarian or whatever they may be like, they almost surely will want to stay in power. Right? So they will. They if they come to power, they will be deterrable. Right. The difficulty is if irregular groups, terrorists, get control of weapons of mass destruction, and something like biologicals, much more of a worry, and chemicals to a certain extent, but biologicals especially, than nuclear weapons, I think. Right? Mm-hmm. Then they are not deterrable. In other words, we've always known that deterrence does not cover this kind of situation. As the cliche now is, of course, that it has been for a long time, that you have to have an address. You can't threaten retaliation. You can threaten retaliation against Iraq. You can't threaten retaliation against terrorists because you can't find them. You don't know where they are.
So if it is the responsibility of the most powerful country in the world as part of its own interest you suggest in your book, to do some of the public goods,
yeah.
to do some of the management of the whole system,
right.
what does a sensible policy look like for addressing this threat, which might come from a transnational terrorist group that does not have power?
What indeed can one do about that? You know, everything possible to prevent nuclear materials, including nuclear warheads, from getting into their hands. We do that to some extent. That is, we've subsidized Russia to enable it to take better care to dismantle its nuclear weaponry and to guard the nuclear weaponry that it does have. And that makes great sense. I mean, and we should do more of that. We should continue to deter and contain countries that do or might have nuclear weapons. But if a country badly needs and therefore badly wants nuclear weapons, it is almost impossible in the long run to prevent that country from acquiring nuclear military capability. Now, one thing we can do about that, see, if we declare a country to be a part of an axis of evil, right, and if that country is anyway in a perilously weak position, as obviously North Korea is, then we have to ask ourselves, if we were the ruler, no matter how nasty that ruler is, right, if we were Kim Il-sung, wouldn't we conclude that, my God, we're likely to be attacked, likely to be attacked, and since we're weak, we'll lose, unless we have nuclear weapons, which have proved to be the greatest and indeed the only reliable deterrent the world has ever known. Conventional deterrence has not worked very well, and we can figure out why that is, but nuclear weapons have been a great deterrent. Now, if one were Kim Il-sung, it's impossible to imagine that he would not want and do everything he can do. So you could make this less likely by making him feel less insecure. The more insecure you make him feel, see, any fool can see that the only way you can deter the United States is with weapons of mass. That you cannot compete on conventional grounds. That's absolutely impossible. Russia can't do it. China can't do it. Obviously, these rogue states, it's just a fantasy. They could not even begin to, right? So if they believe that their security is directly endangered, and even indeed specifically by the United States acting in conjunction with other countries in the area, they are going to do everything they can to acquire deterrent weapons. Again, the best one being nuclear military means.
Ken, one final question requiring a brief answer. Other than reading your books, how should a student prepare for this uncertain future if they're interested in international politics?
Well, one good way of doing it is, of course, read the New York Times. I mean, that's right. And in addition to reading, I think International Security is an excellent journal, right? In other words, what can you do? You can read, you can discuss, you can think. There's not much more you can do. Oh, you can become politically active. Yes, of course, you can become politically active.
Okay. Well, on that note, Ken, I want to thank you very much for spending this time with us and sharing with us your intellectual journey. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.